hour, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this week's edition of the Sunday Spin for Sunday, April the 10th, 2016. This is our weekly recap of the political scene for the week that was and our heads up on what you can expect in the days ahead. So time to grab your Sunday paper and a good hot cup of coffee, and we'll get your week started off on an informed note. Well, What an April this has been, Dave and Sam. I got to tell you, here I was Friday, you know, getting set for the weekend and watching TV, the White Sox home opener on TV, and you'd see a pitch, and then you'd see some snow, and then you'd see the sun come out, and then there'd be another pitch, and then there was more snow.
And we had snow and sunshine around 5 o'clock downtown on Friday here.
Yeah, I mean, and like today, it's almost a taste of all the seasons that we're getting. I mean, 5 o'clock when I walked outside, it was snowing. By the time
we had sleet when I was coming in.
Well, it's probably because it's colder in my neck of the woods than yours. That's the coldness in my heart.
Okay, that's what it is.
Yes. But then by the time I got downtown, around 5:30, it had turned to rain, and I was just outside on the WGN Storm Center patio, and it's not raining anymore, but the wind is pretty strong, and we're supposed to be getting up into the 50s today, but just rain most
of the day. Yeah, around 50, and gusty winds. Once again, winter never leaves Chicago without a fight.
No.
So that's what's happening.
I don't think I'm going to be able to put my winter coat away this entire year.
The middle of May, maybe.
You think? Mid-May? Oh, I hope it's before then.
Sam, you were out at the Cell on Friday for the opener, and were giving us reports about the bizarre weather there.
I say this all the time. Cub fans on opening day, they line the bars, high tables. On the south side, though, it's the concrete jungle. They are out there with grills and flags and tents, and, I mean, they're out of their minds. It's bear weather, though, realistically. It feels like a bear's tailgate.
Well, Sam, it's a bear's tailgate party.
Exactly. I saw some of the pictures that you tweeted from the tailgate out there, and I'm going, do they think there's a Bears game today?
Well, they're all liquored up and ready to go. You know? I pulled into the lot at 11:30 in the morning. Game started at 3:10, mind you.
Right.
And these people are getting it at noon.
Well, you know, considering some of the seasons that the White Sox have had recently, I can understand what they were doing.
I saw something yesterday that I've never seen before, ever, in terms of baseball attire for fans. I saw several people walking around with the big winter hats with the flaps that you can pull down over your ears.
Yeah, the big furry Russian type hats.
The big furry Russian
hats. With the Sox logo on them?
Yeah, they gave those out yesterday. That was like the fan giveaway.
I saw four or five people walking around with those yesterday, and I thought, doesn't that say it all?
No, Dave, they gave those out.
Did they give them out? That's why they were wearing them.
The first 10,000 frozen fans got one.
I had never seen that before. You would think, you know, that would be Bears attire, you know, a Bears hat with the Bears logo on it. But no, it said White Sox.
I thought they were pretty cool looking.
Well, they were great, but I mean, you want a summer hat with the baseball on it, right? I mean, a lightweight shirt and a baseball, classic baseball hat. No, this is a northern exposure type of hat.
Well, given the way the field looked yesterday morning before the crew got to it, I thought it might be the Hawks might be playing their final regular season game outside at the Cell this year. I mean, what a mess it was. And the grounds crew did a great job to get that field in shape.
The tarp was frozen out of the field.
Oh, I'm not surprised.
They had to shovel the lip of the tarp off. And the sod father, Roger Bossert, got it done. Like you said, Rick, the field was covered in snow, and they were spraying it down, and it was ready to go.
Yeah, Roger just, I mean, he is the man. There's no doubt about it. And that was kind of the bizarre thing yesterday, too, was, you know, that snow, I wasn't really expecting to stick on Friday, and it was okay to traverse things a little bit. It was a little wet, but it wasn't that slippery out. But boy, it froze like crazy overnight. And Saturday morning was a nice kind of a slip and slide event all over the place.
It really was,
and you know, kind of dangerous, really.
Well, we had a fatal accident.
Yes,
on the Eisenhower. As it turned out, the chef from Le Bouchon was involved in that accident, a French restaurant here in Chicago.
Yeah, very tragic, and he apparently was outside of his car when that occurred.
Right, and, four injured, and a 13-14 car pileup closed the westbound Eisenhower for hours yesterday.
Yeah, it's, I mean, truly, everybody be careful out there, because with this weather, it is just crazy, and we're going through cycles. Apparently, we're supposed to get a warm front moving in, and that's frankly the cause for the rain that's supposed to be falling most of the day today. But hopefully get into the 50s, and Mike Hamernick says that we could get near 70 by the end of the week. So
that would be quite nice. Sunny for tomorrow, so at least, you know, the dreariness will clear out for the most part.
And that's the Cubs home opener tomorrow.
And it's a Cubs home opener. Exactly.
Dave is earning his money this weekend. Look at that. Full weather on top of it.
Hey, Schwanee knows his stuff. There's no doubt
about trying.
That.
I'm trying.
You do my taxes later?
I'll tell you what. Let's trade, because I haven't figured out mine yet. And we've got, we have until the 18th to file. So we've got a bit of a break. So a week from tomorrow is the deadline.
Well,
if you don't have them in the mail or filed online by then, I'm old-fashioned. I still file them in the mail.
And do you do them on paper?
Oh, yes.
You don't electronic file?
No, I do the state electronically. But
You're old school.
And I have a quill pen that I dip in ink. And sometimes it rips the paper, though, and then I have to start all over.
That was from your days covering the Lincoln administration,
exactly,
I believe.
Yeah.
Yes. some of the great coverage there, you were able to get all those quotes.
It was also I started with the Millard Fillmore administration.
Well, there you go. And we'll be having a quiz later on the chief accomplishments of the Millard Fillmore administration.
We will.
Yes, indeed. Well, Dave is here to keep us up on the news, and we've got Sam Panayotovich with sports. Producer Sean is in today for Jasmine, and he'll be fielding your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's the number you can also text us at, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, all one word. And we're on Twitter @SundaySpin. And engineer Bob still has the snow shovel out this morning that he used a week ago to clean up the board down here. As always, if you have to tune away, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also find our podcasts at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got a great show today. Joining me after the 7:30 news update is Republican Congressman Robert Dold of Kenilworth in the North Shore's 10th District. And the congressman will be here discussing his reelection priorities and the shape of the GOP race nationally. Congressman also, by the way, delivered the Republicans' weekly political address on Saturday. After the 8 o'clock news update from Dave, State Senator Andy Menar, a Democrat from downstate Bunker Hill, joins the show. Senator Menar will discuss his latest plan to change the state school aid formula and the difficult political route that lies ahead. And then after Dave's 8:30 news update, State Senator Michael Hastings of Tinley Park will join us. Senator Hastings, a Democrat, is sponsoring a bill that is getting some attention in Springfield. It would allow local units of government to hire third parties to collect back due fees, fines, and taxes. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
There's a singing waterfall in the mountains far away. That's where I long to be. There
Those are my friends, the Blackest Crow band. That's my friend Annalie Kane, who is doing the singing there. And I thought a little bluegrass country would be a nice way to get us started on this Sunday morning. Now it's time for our weekly spin through national politics. And it's been another interesting week in the presidential campaign as the candidates focus on New York and Pennsylvania and trying to collect delegates. Wyoming caucuses were held on Saturday. Bernie Sanders won those. On the Democratic side, it's been kind of interesting watching the back and forth as both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have really spent a week questioning whether each is qualified to be president of the United States. Here's kind of where that all started, with Hillary Clinton appearing on MSNBC with Morning Joe Scarborough.
Well, I think he hadn't done his homework, and he'd been talking for more than a year about doing things that he obviously hadn't really studied or understood. And that does raise a lot of questions. And really what it goes to is for voters to ask themselves, can he deliver what he's talking about? Can he really help people?
What do you
think? Can he help our economy? Can he keep our country strong? Well, obviously, I think I'm by far the better choice.
So Sanders, the Vermont senator, was asked about Clinton's qualifications by Charlie Rose on CBS.
What I said was in response to what she has been saying. Washington Post headline, quote, Clinton questions whether Sanders is qualified to be president. I thought it was appropriate to respond.
But is it tit for tat? Is that what this campaign conversation ought to be about?
No, it certainly should not be. And as you may know, I have tried to run an issue-oriented campaign, which is what I believe the American people want to hear. They want to hear about what ideas we have to improve their lives, not just attacking each other every day. But what I do have to say, Charlie, you know, if we are getting attacked every single day by the Clinton campaign, I want them to know we're going to respond in kind.
Now, just to make the Democratic race more interesting, former President Bill Clinton, campaigning for his wife in Philadelphia, was confronted by protesters from the Black Lives Matter movement, and he defended his harsher crime sentencing laws during his term in the White House, laws that his wife now says, in retrospect, were probably too tough.
This is what's the matter. I don't know how you would characterize the gang leaders who got 13-year-old kids hopped up on crack and sent them out onto the street to murder other African-American children. Maybe you thought they were good citizens. She didn't. She didn't. You are defending the people who kill the lives you say matter.
That's President Bill Clinton. The former president later acknowledged he probably could have spoken a bit more knowledgeably on the subject with those protesters. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, 99 days to go until the GOP National Convention. Interesting kind of subtext here. The Boston Globe today, in their Sunday edition, published a fake front page looking at what the 1 year into the Trump White House would look like, with a big headline about deportations increasing, tripling of border patrol, curfews extended in multiple cities, rioting breaking out. This was, along with this satirical front page, is also a editorial that is alongside of it, urging the GOP to stop Trump. And this fake front page is the lead of the Globe Sunday Ideas section, and it was produced by the Globe's editorial board and not the newsroom. But you can see a PDF of this front page if you Google the Boston Globe. It's kind of interesting. Texas Senator Ted Cruz is saying that his victory in Wisconsin, he believes, was a pivotal point in the race for the GOP nomination in taking on Donald Trump. Here is Ted Cruz.
Tonight is a turning point. It is a rallying cry. It is a call from the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin to the people of America. We have a choice, a real choice.
Now, questions have arisen about Donald Trump's organization. This actually surfaced yesterday in Colorado. The ability of Trump whether it's really the, his camp is prepared for a convention floor fight for delegates. And even if it's ready for the big California presidential primary in June, Trump was basically shut out of delegates in Colorado. Ted Cruz was able to win those. And, you know, you've got all this going on. And in the meantime, Trump's out there complaining that Ohio Governor John Kasich just ought to get out.
You know, Kasich has what, 1-32. So he's been in 32, I think he has 32 losses and one victory that had I spent another day in Ohio, I would have won, but I wanted to make sure I won Florida, so I stayed. No, but we won pretty, you know, I mean, it was pretty close. So he's won 32. I don't think he should be staying. You know, if you think of it, Jeb did better than him, right? Marco did much better than him. Many people did much better than him.
Now, Kasich continues to point to polls that show him running as the strongest candidate in the general election as a Republican to defeat a Democrat. Here's his latest ad that's airing in New York.
You have only one choice. One choice that will stop the Clinton political machine. John Kasich. Don't be fooled. Ted Cruz can't win the nomination outright. And he can't defeat Hillary Clinton either. John Kasich will win the convention. And he'll defeat Hillary Clinton in the fall. Want to stop the Clinton machine and win the White House? Your only choice is John Kasich.
I'm John Kasich, and I approve this message.
Now, at the same time, Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan of Janesville finds himself continuing to say he isn't interested in becoming the Republican presidential nominee at a brokered convention. But when Ryan released a video late last week, some people began to wonder.
What really bothers me the most of politics these days is this notion of identity politics, that we're going to win an election by dividing people rather than inspiring people on our common humanity and our common ideals and our common culture, on the things that should unify us. We all want to be prosperous. We all want to be healthy. We want everybody to succeed. We want people to reach their potential in their lives. Now, liberals and conservatives are going to disagree with one another on that. No problem. That's what this is all about. So let's have a battle of ideas. Let's have a contest of whose ideas are better and why our ideas are better.
That's House Speaker Paul Ryan, who, even after the release of that video, his folks say, nope, I'm not really interested in becoming the Republican presidential nominee. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now, The Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is our weekly look at the politics that affects the policies that affect your lives. And we've got a lot of bases to cover on this Sunday morning. We were talking about the issue of the Republican convention in Cleveland and how it appears more inevitable, more likely than ever, that it's going to be a brokered convention. Ted Cruz racking up delegates at various state conventions, including delegates that aren't necessarily ones that are bound in states where Donald Trump won. We're seeing kind of some problems within the Trump organization over trying to mount the right kind of people to basically wrangle up these convention delegates and keep them in line. In Colorado, for example, the person they tapped to provide the state convention a list of who were Trump delegates actually put down the names of people that were Ted Cruz delegates in some instances. So the Trump people were telling people, vote for these people, but they were really backing Ted Cruz. So a lot of disorganization going on in the Trump campaign. Ted Cruz using his ability to wrangle up delegates in places that you would expect to find that Donald Trump would be doing very well with. So a lot of problems there. But there was an interesting recap kind of video that the folks putting on the convention in Cleveland sent out. And it takes us all the way back not that long ago to when you had basically 17 candidates for the Republican nomination. And it brings us to basically to where it looks like it's going to be down to just three going into Cleveland. And so I want you to kind of listen to this, and you're going to hear it's a mashup, basically, of all of these candidates. And I want you to listen to it. See if you can pick out who is saying what at the various points in this video from the Republican National Committee. This is On the Road to Cleveland.
And that is exactly why today I am running.
I have decided.
I'm a candidate.
I am officially running.
As a candidate.
For president.
For the Republican nomination.
President of the United States.
Republican voters are setting records with voter turnout.
Participation was up more than 57%.
Well, now the time has come for our generation.
I am asking you to believe.
So that we can create greater opportunity for every American tomorrow.
And that's why working together,
we can change this nation.
It's Super Tuesday.
Fox News can now project.
CNN is projecting
our first projections in this race for the White House.
And then there were three.
I believe in the power of millions of courageous conservatives rising up.
By staying together with our eyes on the horizon.
And we will make America great again.
These candidates are going to come together and unify in Cleveland and get behind that nominee.
Join us!
Kind of an interesting mashup there. That was at the end that was the Republican National Committee Chairman Reince Priebus basically saying that he was the party would unify in Cleveland. Now, of course, we've heard all the controversy going on, and, you know, that's I don't know about unity because you're seeing it right now play out in some of these state conventions as well. So just very interesting times. Well, joining us now on the phone is U.S. Representative Robert Dold from the North Shore 10th District. And Congressman Dold delivered the Republican Weekly radio address yesterday, and it was on the subject of this really growing, troubling dilemma of opioid abuse. Congressman, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Rick, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
You know, I'm not going to ask you to go ahead and recite the whole address from yesterday, but, I mean, tell me a little bit about what, you know, what can be done at the federal level. I know there's a lot of modeling kind of going on over very successful efforts in Lake County to deal with this.
Right, and that's really where I am coming from this, is that we're hearing from constituents about, you know, the various issues that they're dealing with. We're seeing the rise of overdoses that are happening throughout the greater Chicago area. We are losing someone every 3 days to a heroin overdose. And so literally, we need to be pulling stakeholders together. And so I am part of the task force up in Lake County to try to come up with solutions to problems specifically revolving around heroin. And so we're coming up. And so one of the pieces of legislation that I've introduced is something called Lolly's Law. It's named after Alex La Liberté, who was a Buffalo Grove resident, went to Stevenson High School. He was a good student, was an athlete, had good, a lot of friends. But basically in his sophomore year of college would be hospitalized, and they didn't know what was going on. And actually what they ended up realizing was is that he was addicted to prescription drugs and was going through withdrawals. And so eventually this is something that he ended up overdosing and eventually passing away in his sophomore year of college. And no one should have to deal with that. No parent should have to go through that grief. And so what we're seeing is that we're seeing the biggest gateway into heroin abuse is through prescription drugs. And so my bill, the Lolly's Law, would basically make access to naloxone, which is the heroin antidote, more readily accessible. We've been working with stakeholders like Walgreens and others, and Walgreens has graciously offered to put 500 prescription take-back boxes throughout the United States. They also agreed to put naloxone as an over-the-counter
drug for sale.
So they are able to do that in 35 states. This is going to be a big step forward, but there's a lot of things from the federal government in terms of legislatively that we have to do, but we're not waiting for the federal government in legislation. We are working with local stakeholders to move us forward.
Well, this again, you mentioned about with what Walgreens is doing, and I remember there were efforts, years ago here in Illinois to try to have these kind of collection boxes, but there were concerns about security of those. There were concerns, quite frankly, about federal regulation regarding, returning prescription drugs and,
right.
and that chain of command kind of thing. So obviously
that still
some
is a huge concern. There still is a concern with regard to, and that's why right now in Lake County, for instance, we have 27 prescription drug take-back boxes. They're located at police stations. We've been able to collect 12,000 pounds of prescription drugs right now, and the reason why we're really going after the prescription drugs is that has been highlighted as the number one, or at least one of the very key ways that people get into, called the gateway into using heroin. And so they'll get hooked on Oxycontin and Oxycodone. And so we're working on trying to get the FDA, working with doctors to try to make sure that they're not over-prescribing a bunch of different things that we're really looking to try to do to be able to nip this in the bud. But education is going to be absolutely critical. And many parents out there don't believe that this is an issue in their community. It is. And that's one of the reasons why we're doing everything we can to alert them to this issue.
And I know, at doctor's offices throughout the suburbs, there are notices about, look for these kinds of signs, which you would think in these prosperous suburban areas that this is something that can't happen here, but it is, and frankly it's that cheap availability of heroin.
This is happening every single corner of our communities, and so it knows no economic bounds. People might think, oh, heroin problem, this is for inner city, this is going to be back alleys. That's not the case. It is at Stevenson High School, it's at Natura High School, it's at every single place out there right now. And actually Lake County and Cook County, Northern Illinois is a huge target area for dealers. We're, because of our infrastructure system, Rick, it's actually a great spot for distribution. So we know that this is basically ground zero in the greater Chicago area. And so we have to make sure that we are letting parents know that this is a huge issue. And so oftentimes one of the things that we're trying to do is educate them about making sure if you don't need that prescription drug to get rid of it, as opposed to leave it into your medicine cabinet, because that's where these students, these young people are coming. They'll go to a friend's house and they'll go into the bathroom, into the medicine cabinet, and then they'll gather those prescription drugs and they'll take them to prescription drug parties. They'll put them in a big bowl and people will grab a handful of pills and do pills. And that really is accelerated the number of fatal overdoses that we've had in the area.
We're speaking with Congressman Robert Dold from the North Shore 10th District, Republican from Kenilworth. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
We repair every evening when the sun was sinking low, and we listen to the waters as they ripple.
Those are my friends, Blackest Crow, and they're singing Waterfall, which is a Hank Williams tune, and you can find out more information about them on the internet at www.blackestcrowmusic.com. And want to thank my friend Annalee Kane for sending that along on this Sunday morning in Chicago. We're speaking with Congressman Robert Dold, Republican from the 10th District, about the issue of opioid abuse and Lally's Law, the effort to try to encourage the use of federal resources on this. And Congressman, we've got a call from Ron on this issue. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, good morning, Rick, and to your guest. Congress, I want to speak more specifically about heroin, and I want to talk about what we have discussed in our community on the south and west sides and some of the African-American media, that the sale of heroin openly has been a problem for years. But there's a perception that, and even though those drugs have been out in these white suburban areas, because they come into these areas to purchase it, then it has now become a concern. But here's the biggest problem. Unlike with the crack cocaine epidemic, which, you know, Bill Clinton has caught some heat on recently, it's looked upon as more of a health issue. So sometimes, you know, people have to pull back the cover on these things, because there is evidently some racial overtones as far how this is looked at differently. But again, you know, Rick, it's been a problem with this heroin so openly devastating our communities. But now that I'm just going to put it like it is, white suburban people are having problems. It's a big issue. So, Congressman, can you address those things for me? Have a good day.
All right. Thank you, Ron.
No, and I appreciate the comments and the sentiment. And let me just simply say that this is not a partisan issue. This is not a socioeconomic issue. This has been a problem for a long time. We've seen this problem get exacerbated significantly. And so where we're looking at heroin, it is coming across the border today at a purity level that is much purer than it ever before. Access to it is very easy. It's cheaper than cigarettes. Some say more readily available than alcohol.
Congressman, how did it become so inexpensive?
Well, what's happening is that they're for that dose, for that high, they say it's cheaper than cigarettes. It's become so inexpensive because people it's coming across at that purity level that you choose to use it once, and then the addiction, the high is so intense that people have to have it again. And so it is getting addicted extraordinarily quickly. And therefore, again, the supply that's coming across into the United States, we have a drug superhighway that's basically coming across the Mexican border, really up into the Chicagoland area. This is the drug superhighway, and then it is being distributed significantly.
I'm curious, and I did ask you about this when we did Politics Tonight, too, about the issue of, you know, drug concerns always were looked at as issues of in poor communities, and now that kind of heroin and opiate abuse has kind of mainstreamed, that is it getting a different kind of an attention now?
Well, I think it is getting more attention now, largely because this is something that is getting worse. It's not getting better. And so as we look at, yes, we're going to continue to have a war on drugs. We're seeing that the biggest, you know, again, gateway in this is prescription drugs. And it's one of the reasons why we're dealing with physicians and trying to make sure that they're aware in terms of how they prescribe. I have been working with a number of members of Congress, working with the FDA. The FDA today has, you're able to prescribe OxyContin, some of the opioids, for moderate to severe pain. I believe it should be just for severe pain. But as the caller was highlighting before, I mean, this is an issue that, you know, we used to think about heroin being shot up using needles and the like, and that was something that a lot of people wouldn't cross. They wouldn't want to use needles to do those types of things. Today, you can snort it, you can smoke it. It comes in a lot of different ways for you to be able to ingest the heroin, and so therefore you see the ability for people to use it and actually the use of it going up significantly. So this is an enormous problem, and frankly, we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can in every community, and that's why I think it's getting the attention that it has, not only in the United States Congress, but by local elected officials and the like.
Just as an
example, Rick, in Lake County, Illinois, the police force up in Lake County, the first responders, have been able to save 70 lives in just over a year with naloxone because they've asked to have it in their vehicles.
We've got a call from Dominique. Dominique, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning. It's Dominic.
Dominic, I'm sorry.
That's okay. No problem. Good to talk to you both. I just wanted to speak for a minute to the congressman, but also really to parents listening out there to reinforce what he was saying about being aware that this is something that can happen across cultural lines, across income lines. It could happen to anyone. My family of four children were raised in the suburbs. We were raised with somewhat affluence. I was successful in business. And the fourth of my children became addicted to drugs.
A blue Toyota sedan was headed.
Eventually, heroin. And it took us a while to believe that it could be happening to us. But it did, and he now is an addict, and he's in and out of recovery. But I think it's important for all parents to not ignore signs that they might see, and just to believe that it is out there everywhere, and you have to watch your children from early ages, including, you know, the early high school years, for signs of dependency, addiction, and the friends that they're with, and things like that, because it can happen everywhere.
Dominic, thank you very much for sharing that story with us. I appreciate it very much. Congressman, is there a federal funding component to this to help, like, maybe local law enforcement around the country to be able to get that naloxone and that kind of thing? Is that part of this legislation you're looking at?
Well, that certainly, in terms of resources, that's always something to the federal government in terms of grants and grants for first responders and the like. We're also looking at what we can be doing in terms of just education out there to make sure people are aware of this. But one of the things that I'm really trying to do, Rick, is not wait for the federal government. You know how difficult it is to pass federal legislation in certain areas. We're working with local stakeholders. So whether it be the schools, whether it be local law enforcement, and what's interesting, we're working with the state's attorney's office. We're working with places like NACASA, who deal with, as Dominic was talking about, they're dealing with the addictions and trying to deal with those that are already have a problem. So we're really trying to get everybody together around the table so that we're not only identifying it quicker, but we're actually trying to provide treatment. And so we do need to be able to focus on this treatment aspect of it because it is absolutely critical. But there are local organizations like the Fuller Center and other places that are also trying to step up and have an impact. And that's why we are not waiting for the federal government to do it. We'll obviously continue to do so, but we're really trying to have an impact much more quickly in communities throughout the greater Chicago area.
Congressman, we just have a couple of minutes left in this segment. I want to shift gears and obviously talk some politics with you. And it's no secret of your disdain for Donald Trump. But are you planning on going to Cleveland for the convention?
If it's an open convention, I think that that will be something that most people will want to be at to try to make sure that we're guiding, you know, where this goes, or at least trying to influence in some way, shape, or form. So I'm just not sure yet whether we're going to be there or not, or whether we're spending time here in the district. My initial plan is to go.
I started the program by playing the soundtrack of a video that Speaker Paul Ryan released that talked about, you know, what the goal of the party should be, and it shouldn't be about divisions, and that it ought to be, that politics ought to be a contest of ideas between conservatives and liberals. And immediately there was speculation that here is Speaker Ryan, who's not a candidate for the nomination, wanting to be a candidate for the nomination.
No, and let me just put an end to that notion. That's something, if you've listened to Speaker Ryan in the past, that is something that would absolutely be right along his mantra. He's been saying those types of things, talking about the American idea, laying out a vision for where, you know, the Congress wants to take the country. So this is something that is not, well, let me put on a different hat. Let me try to see what I would say if I were running for president. That's not what the Speaker is trying to do. The Speaker is, you know, he's the third in line right now for the presidency, and has a big job with regard to trying to lead the United States Congress forward. And so, you know, he likes to say he has, you know, constituencies. He's got, you know, the first district in Wisconsin as a constituency, and then the members of Congress as a constituency, now as the Speaker. And so we are trying to, at this stage of the game, lay out a bold vision about where we want to take the country and lay out that vision so that the American people can take a look at it and say, that's what we're looking for.
That's Congressman Robert Dold, Republican from Kenilworth in the 10th District of Illinois. Congressman, thank you very much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
Rick, it's always great to be with you.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and this is the second hour of your Sunday Spin, our weekly look at politics. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. Right now, we're going to speak to State Senator Andy Menar, a Democratic State Senator from Bunker Hill down in Macoupin County. And Senator Menar, you've been in the news a little bit lately.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thanks. Thanks for joining me this morning. And the reason that I wanted to have Senator Menar on the show is because last week he unveiled the, I guess I'd call it the latest iteration of your very dedicated efforts to try to change the state school aid formula, change the way that state dollars are distributed to local school districts. And this is just it's such a difficult issue.
Oh, without a doubt. You know, I was looking this morning, Rick, last time I was on the show, which I think was the first time I was on your show, it was about a year and a half ago. And this is actually our third attempt with an actual bill. You know, we're not just talking about the issue. We're trying to file a specific legislation, because I think that's part of the effort that has to go on in Springfield in order to change what is the least equitable system of public school finance in the country. So we're not attacking this through rhetoric. We're trying to do it through specific legislation. And the bill that we filed this week was a continuation of that effort.
Now, I wrote a story that kind of was using your legislation as kind of a launch point of just about the difficult politics, the political road ahead in any efforts to try to change school funding. And, you know, for years, let's face it, we've talked about a state that really kind of defines the way it funds its schools by virtue of what zip code you live in. And about whether that is truly a fair way to do it, and denying children in less property wealth school districts the same opportunities that others have.
I think you hit the nail on the head. And I don't think there's too many people in Springfield. You know, when I talk to lawmakers of both sides of the aisle from all parts of the state, no one's denying the inequity. And that wasn't the case a year ago. I think there was still some belief that, you know, maybe this problem isn't as bad as what, you know, we read about, or, you know, maybe that's a little overstated. But I think we've gotten over that, you know, kind of that challenge that there really is deep inequity in Illinois. And you don't have to go too far. You can look at neighboring districts in the suburbs, for example, where one school district spends well over what's adequate, you know, well over what's adequate, maybe double, for example, and you have a neighboring school district that's just struggling to do basic core services of what we think, all of us think, a school district should offer. So I think we're over that hump. And you know, to the credit of many, you know, Democrats and Republicans, this is now a daily conversation across the state. And I think that's a step forward, because now we have to figure out, what do we do to fix it? How long is that going to take? Because it's not going to change overnight. You know, this is something that's been decades in the works in Illinois. And so what my focus is let's have this conversation in a real way in Springfield, based on legislation, not, you know, the political rhetoric that comes with school funding, which is as charged as it gets. But let's talk about, how do we put a stop to the system we have? How do we transition over time to a new system, knowing that process will benefit kids regardless of where they live in the state?
So maybe without going into the deep dive into this, into changing the formula, I mean, maybe you could just kind of outline what you're looking to do here.
Sure. It's a straight up proposal that says that we should prioritize how we spend our money, about, you know, between $12 and $13 billion in the state budget. We should change how we prioritize that money and how it's distributed to school districts. We distribute money based on a formula that was put in place in 1997 under a bipartisan General Assembly and Governor Edgar. And we know, and everybody listening knows, that the state, all parts of the state, have changed significantly since 1997, but we still distribute the money the same way. So the bill simply says that we should prioritize our money first in districts that need the most resources, that have the highest rates of poverty, the highest rates of concentration of poverty, the most numbers of bilingual students, the things that truly drive the cost of a school district that aren't recognized to the extent that they ought to be in today's distribution model of money to schools. So whether we have a lot of money in the state budget, which we don't today, clearly we're struggling, or whether we have a mountain of money to distribute, how we distribute that money has a severe impact on school districts. And we haven't changed it at all since 1997. So we're saying, let's prioritize our money first so that the schools spending the least adequate amount of money are prioritized at the front of the line. Today, Rick, they're at the back of the line. And that's why that gap gets wider and has gotten wider and will continue to get wider if we don't change something.
And of course, when we talk about school funding, we always are confronted with that issue of the winners and the loser districts, the have districts, the have not districts, and the suburban districts that many suburban districts that don't receive a very much money from the state, but yet they're reluctant to give that up.
Yeah, this is the biggest struggle, and not just bills that I've proposed or my colleagues have proposed, but this is the biggest struggle in a budgetary conversation as well. The idea that we have proposals on the table where some districts would gain money and other districts would lose money, and my approach to that has not been insensitive to reductions. But I want to remind everyone that we have a system of winners and losers today. And every year, our funding formula, not just the one that I've been proposing, but the one that's in place today, sets up and creates a system of winners and losers. But under today's formula, the losers are the districts that have the most challenges, the highest rates of poverty, and more oftentimes than not, the highest rates of taxes. So we have winners and losers today, and it's severe, and it's something that we have to talk about and tackle. That is, as you know, Rick, is not an easy thing to do. And the governor has talked about this extensively, but the governor's own budget proposal, for example, to illustrate my point, the governor's own budget proposal has winners and losers, and he doesn't talk about that too much. He has proposed a budget that fully funds the current foundation level, but that still sets up sending less money to districts that have the highest rates of poverty from the state government. And that is the challenge that we have, not just with Governor Rauner's proposal, but with any number of proposals that we've looked at.
We're speaking with State Senator Andy Menar, Democratic State Senator from Bunker Hill, about his proposal to change the way that the state sends out its share of dollars to local school districts. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Friends from Blackest Crow helping with provide us with a little bit of music this morning. BlackestCrowMusic.com for more information. We're speaking with State Senator Andy Menar Democratic State Senator from Bunker Hill down in Macoupin County about his proposal to change the way the state distributes the state share of dollars to public schools. And Senator, I know that this latest proposal also does take into consideration some aspects involving the Chicago public schools. Could you address those?
Yeah, it does. You know, part of what we're trying to accomplish here is a system that, as close as possible, treats every district in the state in the same way. And we have today in our system today, Rick, special deals for different types of school districts. You know, for example, the Chicago Block Grant that guarantees the Chicago public school system a certain amount of money from different programs in the state budget that they access, a guaranteed amount of money that was set up 20 years ago for the Chicago public school system. You know, on the other end of the spectrum, we have transportation dollars that are accessed more easily by districts that have a large rural footprint, for example, or that have big busing costs because they have to move kids long distances. We have other programs that suburban districts access to a greater extent than other school districts. So we have this system that sets up this idea that some districts have access to some money and others have access to other money, but doesn't allow the same access in the state budget for every district. So you don't have to look too much further than CPS to find a glaring example of this, where the Chicago public school system pays for nearly its entire cost of its pension system, while 865 or 66 other school districts in Illinois have nearly all of their costs paid for into the teacher retirement system, or TRS, through payments appropriated by the General Assembly in the state budget. So that is just one example. That's a charged one, right? That's one that is politically charged when we talk about it. But that's just one example of many in our law today, in the laws of the state, supported by our budget, where we set up a system where schools are looked at and treated differently by our public policy. I would argue that type of approach, which was employed 20 years ago, again, has set up this system of deep inequity in the state and has made it very challenging to change. You know, that's a tough one to just not even to change, just to propose. But, you know, I was in Taylorville in my district the other night at a town hall meeting on this issue, where they have laid off 40%. That school district has laid off 40% of their teachers and staff in the past couple of years because they are. Their poverty rate's growing. Their state aid, despite the fact the state is spending more, is declining. They are, you know, what I call the ground zero of this problem. And I stood up in front of that crew of about 100 people, parents, teachers, administrators, and said, you know, we have to deal with this pension issue because we have this just glaring inconsistency in our law. And, of course, that's not going to get me any votes in my district, Rick.
No, and in fact, I pointed out in the story that there's inherent risks among always among downstate lawmakers, regardless of party. But downstate lawmakers, if it appears Chicago might get something and there isn't any kind of an exchange for lawmakers of central and southern Illinois.
Yeah, that's why our bill, Senate Bill 231, would propose to take major steps toward pension parity between school districts. But at the same time, it would remove the guarantee that Chicago Public Schools gets through its block grant. And that, I think, would get us by the way, that's not set up to make the bill more politically palatable, although I think you could argue it does. It's set up to take major steps toward a statewide system, which we have, and addressing a statewide problem which exists today.
Senator Menar, I want to ask you, this is a question from a Tribune reader that had read my story, and he is a resident of Grays Lake in suburban Chicago, and kind of questions the issue of helping the Chicago Public Schools, given the fact that you have the different rate of assessments in Cook County versus the rest of the state, and when it comes to, you know, how property values are reflected on property taxes. And, I mean, should that be an issue, concern, you know, to be considered in all of this?
Well, I'm not sure if the values itself should be, but, you know, we've had discussions, and if you go back to the EFAC, Education Funding Advisory Committee.
See, I knew you were going to go geeky on me.
Yeah. It's hard not to.
I understand.
You know, if you go back to our bipartisan hearings we had in the Senate, you know, here's another area where we have to have this conversation, which is difficult, where, you know, the tax rates and the level of taxes that are being put on the table by local school districts between Chicago and the rest of the state. This is an issue that, you know, that suburban representation in the General Assembly brings up, and it's a legitimate issue that we have to have more parity when it comes to how much do local units of government, in this case school districts, put on the table so that we have a better balance of state and local funds to fund school districts in Illinois while prioritizing state resources to try to mitigate those large gaps where, for example, districts like East St. Louis couldn't tax themselves enough, even if they wanted to,
and already
equity on their own,
and already are taxing at very high rates. But there's no property wealth.
There's no property, correct? But in Chicago, that argument doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. So that has to be part of this discussion too.
So, what's the next step here? I know that. Certainly Senate President Cullerton is supportive of this legislation, but then we look at across the chambers to the House, and Speaker Madigan, for one, has been more of the position, particularly about the pension issue, about that ought to be a local district, local taxpayer pickup, not a state pickup.
Yeah, that's something that Speaker Madigan has talked about now for, you know, quite some time. I think going back to when we started our process in the Senate to focus on the funding formula aspects of the conversation. I would make the argument, though, that, you know, if that's a proposal that any member of the General Assembly wants to put forward, then let's commit it to legislation and let's have that debate. There's all kinds of ramifications of that because we're talking about billions of dollars there. What we've tried to do in this bill is let's get everyone to the same starting point when it comes to pension parity, because that gets us closer to a system that treats school districts as equally as possible in Illinois. But, you know, how I started, you know, the conversation this morning, Rick, is let's talk about actual legislation and let's commit our ideas, as difficult as they may be, to legislation, because I think that helps the conversation.
Well, and as you said in unveiling this, that if there's one thing, you're open to all the hearing from everybody, but if there's one thing you don't want to hear, it's, oh, we need to study this some more.
Well, that's right, and we've studied this. There's mountains of work about Illinois and how awful our system is. You know, you could take any metric, Rick, and apply a metric to our state today, and we're not going to be anywhere near the middle of the pack, let alone leading the pack. And to get us in a different direction, again, it's going to take time. This isn't going to happen overnight, but we have to recognize that, you know, for example, in Illinois, when you have a student that lives in poverty and one that doesn't, we spend $2,500 on average more on that student that doesn't live in poverty. That's the most regressive system in the country. African-American and Latino students on average have about $2,000 less spent per year on their education compared to their white counterparts. That's hard to hear. It's really hard to say, too, but that's reality today. And, you know, there's other things, for example, you know, mandate relief. That ought to be part of this discussion as well. Representative Sandak, for example, has a bill that's in the House that had a hearing this week. We should work through these issues because I think there's a place where Republicans and Democrats can come to some reasonable middle ground to be part of this larger effort to, over time, make a system in the state that serves all students better.
That's State Senator Andy Menard, Democratic State Senator from Bunker Hill. Senator Menard, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Sunday Spin.
You bet. Thanks for having me, Rick.
We'll be back with more right after this.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning, good rainy Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. President Obama returned home to the University of Chicago last week to pitch Judge Merrick Garland as his choice for the Supreme Court to fill the vacancy left by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. And during a question and answer session with law students at the U of C, he was asked by one student what Garland brings to the table when it comes to diversity.
At no point did I say, oh, you know what, you know, I need a black lesbian, you know, from Skokie. In that slot, can you find me one? You know, that's just not how I've approached it. It turns out that if the process is fair and you are saying that it's important that our courts are reflective of a changing society, you'll end up with a really good cross-section of people who are excellent. And that's who we've been able to appoint. And so when I look at Merrick Garland, that was the person that, you know, the difference between the Supreme Court is just a handful of seats come up at any given time now. I appointed a Latino woman and another woman right before that. So, he's a white guy, but he's a really outstanding jurist. Sorry.
That was President Obama speaking to students at the University of Chicago. Well, joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park. Senator, thank you very much for getting up with me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks.
And traversing through the snow / rain / sleet or whatever to come downtown this morning. First, you were sitting in here in studio while I was speaking with Senator Menard about the changes in his proposed changes in the state school aid formula, and I was wondering where do you fall on that issue? It's a very contentious one.
So I think Senator Menard, when he spoke of the inequities in education across Illinois, there are a lot of inequities from southern Illinois to northern Illinois. I so happen to fall in one of those districts where it's Will and Cook County, so I have extreme losers and extreme winners. And in both counties, it's different property tax assessments. So for me, I'd like to see some sort of property tax reform along with school education funding reform.
Well, and that's why I kind of posed that question that actually it was brought to me from a reader of the Tribune about the issue of that, the differing ways that property assessments are calculated in Cook County versus the rest of the state.
Yeah, if you look at Will County right now, the property value or residential assessment rates and commercial assessment rates are far different than they are in Cook County. Right now, it's better to live in Cook County and run a business in Will County, and that's sort of not the way it should be. It should be equitable across the board. And I hope as we keep on, you know, investigating and pushing for legislation for school funding reform that we actually look at that.
How much of your school administrators are looking at that issue as well as the overall issue of the lack of a budget?
I will assure you that every school superintendent in my district from elementary to high school is watching this very closely. I served on a school board for 4 years, so I have a very in-touch communication with my superintendents. Let's put it this way, there's not a day that goes by where one of them doesn't call.
Okay, but what about as far as concern about obviously this year, the only part of the budget that the governor signed was the elementary and secondary schools budget. But now, you know, where is there going to be an elementary and secondary schools budget for the next school year?
Well, I would hope so. I can tell you that the budget impasse has drastically affected the south suburbs disproportionately than it has to the rest of the state of Illinois. And K through 12 is just a component of the overall budget.
Well, how so?
So if you look at the impasse as a whole, we've had a lot of social services and those that have developmental disabilities, mental health illnesses, senior citizen home care, child care services. Those are all have been adversely impacted in my area. And that's something for me where I've had an open discussion with fellow members of the legislature and the governor's office and saying, hey, look, we're being disproportionately hurt out here, especially in child care. I think you see a great percentage of our child care facilities shutting down, or also not a lot of families allowed to get in because the process takes so long.
Well, and we've talked on this program, too, about those kinds of services. Should magically a resolution on a budget be approved and there's money coming back, that doesn't necessarily mean that these social services come back.
And that's true. I can tell you that some of the social service companies that have been shut down or gone out of business probably won't come back. But also another issue that's come out of this budget impasse that our back bills are starting to accumulate so much that, you know, we're going to start having to allocate money to pay back those back bills as well. So we have a pretty big complex problem on our hands, but I do think that if everyone works together, I think we can get to a solution. It's going to take a lot of work though, Rick.
Have you seen any signs that would conclude anybody to believe a solution is at hand?
I would be remiss to say that, you know, before the primary election, I really didn't see any progress. You know, and after the primary election, you know, you start seeing people talk more and more about it. But it is election season, and people do really different things during election season that probably aren't in the best interest for the state of Illinois.
So not till after the election.
I'm committed to working throughout. But I could tell you this. There's certain, you know, people in positions of power, our governor, for example, who may not, you know, feel the same way. And although his position changes on a monthly basis, I would just like to see some consistency, and I would also like to see some of the trust restored between the legislature and the executive branch. It's not a one-way street.
I mean, I remember the days of Rod Blagojevich, for example, and I'm not comparing anything that Blagojevich did to certainly Governor Rauner, but that issue of trust was just so evaporated that you had legislators asking the governor to sign memorandums of understanding in writing to make sure that deals that were made were actually lived up to. I mean, is that level of trust, is that gone, do you think?
Luckily for me, I was in Iraq, I think, during the time that Rod
Wait, luckily,
was
here. Now,
I don't know if that's a bad thing or
yeah,
a good thing, but
I was just going to say, luckily for you, you were in Iraq,
yeah.
Yes.
A different perspective on life, I think.
Understood.
But, you know, for me, in terms of trust, you know, the governor should get out and really interface more with the legislators and ease up on his extreme positions. You know, for a guy who represents over 20,000 members of labor unions across, you know, in my region, you know, coming out in an extreme stance of let's shut down unions and not have a right to collectively bargain, I think is a pretty hard stance that he probably shouldn't start off with.
I want to talk to you about legislation that you've proposed that which has generated some controversy, but it's legislation that would allow local units of government to more easily be able to contract out to a third-party vendor the ability to try to recover debts that are owed to that local government, sales taxes, delinquent taxes, fees that haven't been paid. Can you run us through what this is all about?
So just to frame it, so what happens is that towns are entitled to sales tax revenue from their businesses that they have inside their town. And when you make a purchase, the sales tax goes to the Department of Revenue, and then the Department of Revenue redistributes it to other towns. The Department of Revenue runs on such an antiquated system that some of those revenues that may take place in Tinley Park may go to Schaumburg or some other town. So there's information that the Department of Revenue collects in terms of where the revenues go, where the businesses are, and it pretty much can pinpoint where the tax dollar should go to. So what this bill does is it allows towns to contract with technologically savvy companies to analyze all the tax revenue and say, hey, we're missing out on, you know, $300,000, $250,000, because it's going to X, Y, and Z towns.
Almost like those communities that, like, do their own census as an effort to try to get more of that local government distributive fund, their bigger share of the income tax, because they would contend that we haven't accounted properly.
Right, and in a lot of cases it hasn't. And there's some huge towns in Illinois, Springfield, Moline, Chicago Heights are just three of the few that have realized that I missed out on $250,000 in tax revenue that I was already owed. So it's not new information. It's just information that's out there that is being audited. And then those revenues will go back to the town in which they were entitled to anyways. My issue that I have is, you know, not only getting the revenue back to where it belongs to, but also protecting that data and making sure that, you know, the data doesn't get into the wrong hands.
And that's where the controversy, I think, does exist. And we're going to talk more about that when we come back. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN. Thank my friends from Blackest Crow, blackestcrowmusic.com, for the music accompaniment today to the show. It's Hank Williams' tune, singing Waterfall. I'm here in the Allstate Showcase studio with Democratic State Senator Mike Hastings from Tinley Park, and the senator has a bill that is an effort to try to get the right amount of tax reimbursements to local communities, and part of this is to allow the use of third parties to analyze the data and then go back to the state and say, you know, hey, you owe us, so we're owed a little bit. I mean, the issue that has raised controversy is whether there is something nefarious about allowing a third party vendor to see tax data, and
right,
and if it falls into the wrong hands.
See, people misconstrue this. They think, well, we're giving out Social Security numbers, we're giving out all this personal information. That's not what it is. We're giving out the business name, the address, the net revenues that are due to the town. It's not like we're giving out sensitive data towards, like, where you live as a person. I think that's where people get confused in this. Third parties are used in a lot of different situations. And in this one, it's no different than anything else. You use a third party to audit your village. You use a third party to be your legal representation. This is no different. The third party will go ahead and analyze your data, and then they'll find out what revenues that you're missing out on that you're already owed. So confidentiality for me is far important. Right now, the department, any municipality can request this information. Not all of them can analyze it. But the Department of Revenue, what they do now is they put all this information on a CD and they send it through the mail. It's not encrypted. There's no mechanism in there to protect it. They send it through the mail. So Joe Schmo, who intercepts the mail, can get all the tax revenue data for a municipality. That's not the way it should be either. So my bill does a few things. We want to have some sort of encryption, some sort of protection for that data. So if a third party gets it, that information is locked and there's, you know, some sort of security measure there. Not to mention these companies have to sign a confidentiality agreement with the town, and then they have to act only with the town as long as they're doing business, they can have the information. So for me, that's important, is to protect this data for the town, because once it gets out, it's not appropriate for it to get out.
And so it lasts as long as a contract period, basically. And after that, that data has to be returned or whatever.
Right.
Now, one of the things is, so if a company gets hired and they analyze the data and, you know, Municipality X claims they're owed, you know, $2 million, what forces the state to pay that?
So the city's entitled to pay the money anyway. So the Department of Revenue has all the data of what revenues are supposed to be collected and then where it's supposed to go. because of their antiquated system, like I said before, right. goes to the wrong town. So once they analyze the data and then the company shows proof that it's supposed to go to that town, then the Department of Revenue can reallocate the money back to the town. And I think that's what's most important because towns like Chicago Heights, Bloomington, Moline, they've actually found close to, between the three towns, close to $1 million in missing revenue that they were supposed to get, but it went somewhere else. So these towns, they contract with these third-party vendors, and these third-party vendors find the monies that they would have never had if they would have never looked.
So, but if, say it goes to the wrong town, so then there's an adjustment made by Department of Revenue to...
That's correct.
Kind of
equalize it and make it right again. And also to prevent it from happening again.
Why can't we just get the Department of Revenue a better computer system?
You know, that'd be nice, but those things cost money, and in the state of Illinois right now, we're kind of struggling in that regard. But
if it's so antiquated, I mean, and yeah, I know computer systems cost money, but, I mean, the price of computers has kind of, you know, come down a great deal.
I think one of the things, you know, as a Democratic senator that I can agree with the administration on is the fact that across the board, not only in the Department of Revenue, but human services.
Oh, the IT.
We need to invest in, you know, I laughed when I saw that some of our computer systems are run on Fortran. You know, as a guy who's new to the legislature, I said, you know, big business is so far ahead, but, you know, state government takes time to make a transition, and that's one transition we should definitely make.
Is it just because they don't want to spend the money?
Sometimes it's hard to find the money these days.
And, well, that's definitely true.
And that's part of the reason why my bill is, I introduced my bill so local governments can find money for their municipalities. I know they're struggling. You know, and the state needs to find better ways to make better efficiencies for itself.
Well, speaking of local governments, and I have to wonder if in some case this isn't also, your legislation isn't also rooted in concerns on the municipal level, that their share of the state income tax will continue to be somewhat in jeopardy because of the financial straits that we're going through in Illinois. Am I correct in that?
I can tell you that every mayor in my district, I represent 20 different towns, is concerned about their share of the local government distributive fund. It's money in which they pay in and money in which they want to get back so they can help provide services for their town. You know, and I can tell you that's one thing we talk about every year during the budget is how is LGDF appropriated to our municipalities.
And that's the state share of the income tax.
That is correct.
But, I mean, there's no assurance that may not get hit somewhere in the end.
No, you're right. But I can tell you there's no greater lobbyist to a legislator than their individual mayor that supports them. And I can tell you that mayors across Illinois, if you're afraid of getting your LGDF cut, you need to call your legislator. And I can tell you if a legislator doesn't listen to the mayors in their community, I think they're wrong. Legislators take a lot of advice and consent from their municipality leaders, and you know, because they're the pulse of our state, they're the pulse of the community. They know what's going on.
What about legislation even going, carrying it further? I mean, there's been talk about having legislation that assures local governments get their share as a continuing appropriation rather than something that may be subject to the whims in any given budget year.
So myself and Representative Anthony DeLuca of Chicago Heights, we've actually proposed legislation to ensure that the towns get their 10% of their local government distributive fund. It's sort of stalled in the House and it's stalled in the Senate, but we're going to continue to advocate for that.
Why is it stalled? I mean, I would think your mayor is here again as being a powerful
lobby. A lot of mayors,
but,
you know, in terms of balancing the budget as a whole, I think that other people want a more collective approach than, you know, promising one entity one thing and not promising another entity another. So they want to have everything on the table when we make a decision in order to produce a budget.
Kind of like if school districts, per se, were given that kind of guarantee of an automatic appropriation that isn't subject to the whims of the General Assembly.
Right.
It sounds like there's a lot of talking that still needs to be done in Springfield, though, to put all these various puzzle pieces together.
There's a lot of time left, Rick, in the legislative session here. You know, a lot of time can be 1 week or 1 month or 1 day. In my experience, I've been down there for 3.5 years, and I can tell you that it's been, you know, coming from running the ground and air operations for one of our commanding generals in Iraq to go in the Springfield. There's a lot of similarities between combat and Springfield, but you know, there's a lot of work to do. It's just going to make, we need a lot of commitment from all branches of the government, the executive branch, legislative branch, to really make sure that, you know, we get the job done.
But are you satisfied that everybody's got that commitment?
No.
In all parties? I'm not asking you to
I'm not.
I don't want you to necessarily name names, but I think the very valid question, and we kind of touched on this, is if you're looking at political advantage, if somebody's looking at political advantage, certainly that diminishes the desire to try to reach a settlement.
I would hope that, you know, all legislators have an executive branch, have all the commitment that they need to get the job done. But, you know, it's unfortunate some don't. And I'm not going to name names, but I'll tell you this much, you know, to hold people hostage for political gain is wrong.
And there's a lot of hostages.
A lot of hostages, and you're seeing a lot of hostages go under. And for me, that's unacceptable. You know, our job is to be the voice for the voiceless in Springfield, and I'm committed to doing that, and I think that's why the people in my district reelected me this year.
That's Michael Hastings, Democratic State Senator from Tinley Park. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning here in the Allstate Showcase studio.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this.